You're listening to DTFHN for August 19th, 2020. The strongest case against OpenLogi goes like this. A mouse is a solved problem. HID has been a standard since 1996. Plug in a pointing device. The operating system knows what to do with it. So a project that exists to talk a proprietary protocol to a proprietary receiver is not liberation. It's participation. It legitimizes the idea that a pointer needs a daemon. And there's already Solr on Linux, so this is duplicated effort. A second implementation of a thing that shouldn't need one implementation. That argument is well constructed, and it fails at the first joint. HID is the floor, not the ceiling. The standard gets you cursor movement and 5 buttons. It does not get you gesture binding. Per application profiles, flow across 3 machines, FN lock state, blacklight curves, or the 50Hz to 60Hz webcam toggle that one commenter that went hunting for and never found. Logitech built HID++ on top precisely because the base standard ran out. The protocol extension isn't the problem. Where the documentation for it lives is the problem. And the duplication complaint gets it exactly backwards. Solr is Linux only, Python. A decade of accumulated device knowledge. OpenLogi ships a signed MSI for Windows 11. Deb and RPM and ARC packages with UDEV rules and a systemd user unit, and macOS. That is not a fork. That is a second team reading the same reverse-engineered protocol notes and building for the platforms the first team didn't reach. Two independent implementations of a spec is how a spec becomes real. The historical parallel is exact. In 1991, Andrew Trigil wanted his DEC Pathworks machine to talk to his PC, so he wrote a packet sniffer and inferred the SMB protocol from the wire. Microsoft never published it. Samba shipped anyway, and by the 2000s, Samba was the reference implementation. The thing you tested Microsoft's own behavior against. The company eventually published documentation because a free implementation had already made the protocol public property. Reverse engineering didn't erode the standard. It created one. Look at what OpenLogi actually validated. Bolt, unifying and light-speed receivers, plus direct Bluetooth, plus USB, across 6 mice, keyboards, lateral lights, and webcams. Every transport, every device class. That's not a weekend hack. That's someone doing the boring matrix work. No account. No telemetry. The only network traffic is device images and an update check that ships off by default. Your mouse should not need a login. Somebody finally built the version where it doesn't. Hardware that respects you on the desk. And now hardware that redefines what's possible in the rep. 2 microseconds. That's the number in the CS4 announcement that deserves more attention than the token counts. Wafer-to-wafer latency, without a switch, across racks. Everything else in that page is throughput bragging. That one is architecture. Now, let me argue against myself. Because the obvious take here is, finally, a challenger to NVIDIA. I want to push back on that. Cerebras isn't competing with NVIDIA's silicon. It's competing with NVIDIA's networking. The dirty secret of large model inference is that the bottleneck moved off the chip years ago. It's the interconnect, the switch fabric, the hop count between the places where your model's weights actually live. NVIDIA understood that. Which is why they bought Mellanox. Removing the switch entirely from wafer-to-wafer communication is an attack on the part of the stack that actually generates the lock-in. And here's where the devil's advocate case fails in an interesting direction. You'd think a company shipping a single wafer the size of a dinner plate would be the most proprietary thing imaginable. You cannot fab this in a garage. You cannot fork it. There is no community edition of a 5-nanometer wafer. That's true. But look at what the readers notice. The specs imply that a frontier closed model runs somewhere around 50 billion active parameters. Someone read a throughput claim and back-derived the architecture of a model whose weights are a trade secret. Physics leaks what press releases won't. The complaint underneath all of this is the one that matters most, and it's the least glamorous. Cerebras is fast, and you can basically never use it. Scarcity, waitlists. A preview instance of an already superseded open weights model, offered as a demo rather than a product. Speed that exists on a slide deck is not speed that exists for you, which is exactly why the open weight side of this equation is the part carrying the weight. Kimmy, GLM. These are models you can download, quantize, and run on whatever silicon you can get your hands on. When the hardware is scarce, portable weights are the only thing that keeps the capability reachable. A closed model on scarce hardware is 2 choke points stacked. An open model on scarce hardware is 1, and 1 is survivable. The wafer is a genuine engineering achievement. The question is whether it ends up serving people who can only rent it by the minute. 2 choke points down to 1. That's the physical layer. Now let's go up the stack to where the arguments get really fun. Story 3. 200 million lines of code, refactored across an entire company code base in 20 minutes. That's a number from Chandler Carruth's committee bio, and it explains the entire C++ Civil War better than any standards paper does. Here's the split. Late last year, C++ Evolution Working Group locked in a design principle. No ABI breaks, no viral annotations, keep link compatibility with C and with every previous version of C++, stability forever. And the justification from Herb Sutter is refreshingly honest. Decades of experience show that most customers with large code bases cannot and will not change even 1% of their lines. Not for features, not even for safety, unless a regulator holds a gun to the budget. Strip that to first principles and you get something uncomfortable. The C++ committee isn't optimizing for the language. It's optimizing for organizations that cannot rebuild their own dependencies. Somewhere there's a shop linking against a pre-built binary from 1998 whose source is on a dead SourceForge page. And that binary gets a vote on whether the rest of the world can have memory safety. The dividing line isn't big tech versus small shops. The author names it precisely. Can you build your entire dependency stack from version source with tests? If yes, migrations are a Tuesday. You write the tool, you run the tool, you review the diff. If no, every change is a catastrophe and you will fight standardization to the death. Because for you, the standard is the only thing holding your build together. Notice what that first camp actually has. Open source all the way down. Versioned. Buildable. Refactorable. Clang exists. So the tooling exists, so migration exists, so evolution exists. The companies that can move are the ones whose stack they can read. That's not a coincidence, that's a causal chain. And it's why Google, Rust, Carbon, and Swift's interop work all started routing around the committee rather than through it. The commenters are right that there are more than two camps. Someone in the thread notes C++ 98 and Qt 5 just worked. Fair. Nostalgia is a legitimate engineering position when the alternative is a rewrite. But the dream of one dialect-free C++ died a long time ago. What survives is a simpler rule. The people who can rebuild from source get to keep evolving. Everyone else gets frozen at whatever year they stopped having the sources. Moving on. What does it cost to be great at two things at once? Nicolas Charrière went through Y Combinator with a 7-month-old daughter he didn't mention to anyone. Now, 2 kids, a dog, a packed schedule, and a problem he can actually measure. parent him ships visibly less than kidless him did. He read the biographies looking for a template and found something bleak instead. Jobs denied paternity of Lisa because the timing was wrong. Einstein daydreamed about physics while his marriage dissolved around him. Edison, Ford, Ferrari. The same story written in the margins of every one of them. Think about how a tree allocates carbon. Every spring, it makes a decision it can't take back, height or width. Grow tall and you win the light, but you're brittle. A storm takes you down because you spent everything reaching. Grow wide and you're stable for 200 years, and the canopy above steals your sun. Foresters can read this in the rings. The tight bands are the years the tree chose survival over reach. The founder biographies are all tall trees. Spectacular height, catastrophic root systems, and we only wrote the books about the ones that didn't fall over. That's the selection bias sitting under Charrière's whole survey. Nobody publishes the biography of the guy who built something good and also showed up at dinner. There's no narrative tension in it. What he does with this is the part worth admiring. He doesn't solve it. He redefines the objective function. Ambition, restated, be a great dad and build great things. He knows this is harder than either alone. He says hard is the point. The strategy is unglamorous and correct. Clarify what the work actually is. Protect energy. Cut the bullshit. He explicitly rejects the quality time theory. No diminishing returns on hours with your kids. So the optimization target is quantity, which means every hour of theater at work is stolen from somewhere real. A commenter lands the sharpest observation in the thread. He thought he was crushing both, answering bug reports while hiking with his kid in a backpack. Somebody else was absorbing the actual load. That's the honest audit. The tall tree usually has someone underground doing root work nobody credits. The builders worth learning from aren't the ones who optimize a single number. They're the ones who kept the whole system alive long enough to compound. Sustaining systems is one thing, but what if the work itself never decayed, because every proof was machine-checked and permanent? Story 5. Every proof has a load-bearing assumption, and the one under mathematics has always been social. A result is true because someone you trust read it and said so. That works fine when the bottleneck is human attention. It stops working when machines start generating proofs faster than any referee pool can read them. That's the constraint Terence Tao is building against with Palomar, a registry of lean verified mathematics now open for submissions. The problem is specific. A repository shows up claiming to prove something. Does the lean code actually type check? Does it sneak in an extra axiom that makes the whole thing trivially true? And does the formal statement, the thing the machine checked, actually correspond to the English sentence the author says they prove? Three failure modes and Palomar attacks each one differently. A repository submits a challenge file, a short human-readable statement of the claim, alongside a solution module with the actual proof and a formalization.yaml describing the result in plain language. Check one is mechanical. A tool called Comparita confirms the proof, type checks, and proves exactly what the challenge file claims. No cheats, no smuggled axioms. Check two is where it gets strange. A language model reads the informal description and judges whether it semantically matches the formal statement. Non-deterministic verification stapled to deterministic verification, because the gap between symbols and meaning has never been mechanizable. The architecture here is the interesting part. Palomar doesn't host anything. It registers external GitHub repositories at specific commits. Your proof stays yours on your infrastructure. The registry points at it and vouches for the machine checkable parts. Tao is explicit that this is not peer review. It makes no claim about novelty or interest. It's a floor, not a ceiling. A commenter notes Isabel's archive of formal proofs has done a version of this for decades and objects to the GitHub dependency. Fair on both counts. The centralization is a real design smell in a system otherwise built on distributed snapshots. But watch what this does to the door. Submissions are welcome, whether human-generated, AI-generated, or mixed. Tao notes, AI agents handle the mechanical submission work well. There is no credential gate. If your lean compiles and your claims match, you're in the registry next to a Fields Medalist send-off conjecture formalization. That's the ladder staying down. Anyone can hurl a proof into that registry now. And speaking of things launched at implausible speed, Story 6 goes considerably faster. Every control system I've worked with has the same failure mode at the edges. You dump too much energy into the mechanism too early, and the mechanism eats it. Deflection, ringing, a bearing that gets hot for reasons nobody modeled. The fix is almost never more power. The fix is scheduling the power. Tom Stanton built a trebuchet that throws a projectile past the speed of sound. The interesting part is not the speed. It's how he stopped the machine from destroying itself getting there. A conventional trebuchet is a fixed lever. The counterweight falls, the arm swings, the ratio between them is whatever geometry you welded in place. Stanton's version runs the counterweight through a spool with a varying radius, so the effective gear ratio changes continuously during the drop. Early on, the arm is heavy and slow, and the mechanism is fragile, so the ratio is low. Later, when the arm already has momentum, the radius grows and the transfer rate climbs. He is scheduling the energy across the fall instead of releasing it all at once. One commenter finds this backwards. Shouldn't the spool shrink towards zero at the end? So the counterweight arrives stationary and every joule has moved into the projectile? That's the right intuition for a system with no time constraint. But the counterweight has a fixed distance to fall, and the projectile has to be gone before it lands. The radius has to grow, because the arm tip is moving so fast by then that a small spool couldn't keep up with it. The taper is set by the deadline, not by the energy budget. Measured efficiency lands near 40%. Another commenter suggests that iterative modeling of the full system, derivatives, the whole coupled thing, could push it toward 80, a few hundred more miles per hour from arithmetic, rather than steel. Run that forward. The physical machine is unremarkable. Would steel a falling mass, a technology from the 12th century? What's new is the ability to simulate the coupled dynamics well enough to shape the transfer curve before you cut anything. The optimization is the invention, and it's on YouTube, filmed at every failed iteration. With the reasoning visible and the geometry legible enough that the comment section is already arguing about the derivative. Someone will build the 80% version. They'll do it because the 50% version was shown to them completely, including the parts that broke. So we can now simulate a machine's coupled dynamics before cutting metal. What happens when someone does the same thing with a brain? Story 7. Someone in the thread pushed back before they praised. Nice that it's open source instead of the startup version with the sensational claims, they said. But it still presents itself as though the fly is genuinely being driven by the connectome. That's the right skepticism, and the read, me mostly survives it, which is the surprising part. Dennis Segevich built a fruit fly that lives on your macOS desktop. It walks across your window edges, grooms itself, sleeps, and underneath it runs a spiking simulation of a real connectome. Flywire version 783. The reconstructed wiring diagram of an actual fly brain. 668 neurons, about 19,000 real synaptic connections, weighted by measured synapse counts and signed by neurotransmitter prediction. a leaky integrate and fire model at 1 kHz. Here's the part worth admiring. The escape isn't scripted. When your cursor lunges at the fly, that motion becomes looming input to the LC4 and LPLC2 cells. The real visual neurons that detect an approaching object, those feed the giant fiber, the escape command neuron. The fly takes off only if the giant fiber actually spikes, and about 1,200 synapses of feed-forward inhibition are pushing back the whole time, which is why a slow cursor approach gets tolerated and a fast one triggers takeoff in roughly 4 milliseconds. Same as the animal. Nobody wrote an if statement for cursor is closed jump. The behavior fell out of the wiring. The loop closes both ways too. The gate rhythm of the procedural legs feeds back into the circuit's ascending proprioceptive neurons. In phase, fast mouse motion stimulates the wind-sensing partners, and the brain window is clickable. Pick a region. It optogenetically stimulates the 60 nearest neurons for 400 milliseconds, and whatever happens next is whatever the network does downstream. Click DNG11. It grooms. Click one side steering neurons. It turn. The skeptic is right that this is a small slice. 668 of 139,000 neurons. The body's invented. Flywire mapped a brain, not a fly. The README says so, in a section literally titled, What's Modeled Versus Measured? Which brings up the thing that made this possible at all. Flywire is public. The soma positions, the synapse counts, the neurotransmitter predictions. All of it downloadable by anyone with a clone command. A hobbyist project turned that dataset into something you can poke with a mouse and watch spike. That is what open data does. It puts the entire fly brain within reach of a weekend build script. Clone it. Run build.sheet, and there's a fly on your desktop deciding, honestly, whether to flee. From a fly brain, you can clone to a ring forged from a rock that fell out of the sky. Today's stories really are just people getting their hands on impossible material. Story 8. Before anyone could grow a silicon crystal, radio builders hunted for one. The early crystal detectors ran on galena, natural lead sulfide, dug out of the ground, and you probed its surface with a fine wire looking for a hotspot that happened to rectify. You didn't manufacture the sensitive point. You found it. Then Kasikrowski growth arrived, and purified crystal became something you pulled from a melt on demand, in whatever quantity the order called for. The scarce things stopped being scarce, and everything built on top of that scarcity had to renegotiate its term. Bronze Age Greece was living in the galena era of iron. A new study in the Journal of Archaeological Science tested 91 iron objects from 33 sites, held across 19 museums. Using handheld X-ray instruments that read metal chemistry without cutting into the artifact, which is why this could happen on-site instead of never. Meteoritic iron carries high nickel. 13 objects came back nickel-rich. 10 of those, very likely from meteorites. Here's the detail that does the work. The tested objects included tools, weapons, ornaments. Only the finger rings were meteoritic, not blades, not implements. Rings. Downed in richly furnished tholos and chamber tombs at Mycenae, Vifeo, Kakovados, sitting alongside gold and silver. One was on the hand of a man the excavators read as a high-ranking priest at Anamospalia. So the metal that fell out of the sky, the metal nobody could make, went almost exclusively onto the hands of people who already held power. And the researchers note that Greece is a poor place to find meteorites. The climate eats exposed iron, which means most of this material traveled. It came from somewhere arid, through trade, through whatever channels the palaces controlled. The question worth sitting with, was that iron precious because of what it was, or because almost nobody could have one? Because smelting answered it. Once you could pull iron from ordinary ore, a process, repeatable, teachable. The sky metal ring lost its argument. The study is partly about tracking that decline. The status didn't survive the manufacturing. Every scarce thing is eventually one process away from being common. The interesting question is never whether the process arrives. It's who spends the intervening centuries insisting the scarcity was the point. Iron went from sky metal to hardware sore, and now the theremin, pause, an instrument that once needed custom hardware, pause, is just you, a webcam, and a browser tab. Let me make the case against this thing and make it well. It's a toy. A webcam theremin in a browser tab is a 5-minute novelty. You wave, it whines, you close the tab. Latency from a camera feed is nothing like the instantaneous response of an antenna sensing your body's capacitance. Lev Termine built an instrument where the air itself was the circuit. This is a pose estimator guessing where your wrists are 30 frames a second and mapping that to an oscillator. Calling it a theremin is generous, and the one comment on the thread damns it with faint praise. The frame rate is sufficient for some creativity here. Sufficient. There's an epitaph. Now watch that argument eat itself. The objection assumes the point of a theremin is fidelity to a 1920s backing tube heterodyne circuit. It isn't. The point is that the instrument has no surface. You play the boundary. And the moment you accept that premise, follow it to the end. If a musical interface requires no contact, then the instrument has no body, and the only thing defining it is the edge of the sensing field, which is exactly what this build does. Move your hands outside the camera frame, and the sound stops. The frame is the fingerboard. Palms together is a mute. Lean back and the tone softens, because distance from the lens is a real axis and they used it. That's not an approximation of a theremin. That's the theremin's actual thesis, ported to whatever sensor happens to be in the room, which is why the gyro mode isn't a fallback. Tilt your phone. Left-right is volume, forward-back is pitch. And it calibrates to however you happen to be holding it. No sensor at all. The mouse drives it. The principle survives every substitution. Principles that survive substitution were the right principles. And the delivery mechanism is the quiet win. A URL. No install. No store review. No signing key. No permission from a platform holder to make a noise. Somebody built an instrument and put it at an address, and the barrier to playing it is owning a laptop made in the last decade. Termin's instrument required a workshop and a tube supply. This one requires a tab. Instruments aren't the only thing built from a naming problem. Next up, the beautifully bureaucratic system behind why your bookshelf is called Billy. Between 4 and 12 letters, that's the constraint buried in IKEA's naming rules. And it's the one that tell you this is an engineering document pretending to be a brand guideline, not a vibe, a range, with a preference. Preferably contains OAOD and a hard rejection list. Never trademarked, never a surname, must be a real word. That's a validator. Somebody wrote a spec for a namespace. And they did it because Ingvar Kamprad couldn't remember part numbers. The whole system exists as an accessibility workaround for one person's memory, which then hardened into a taxonomy. Sofas get Swedish place names. Bookshelves get men's names. Children's products get animals. 2 to 3,000 new products a year flowing through that pipeline. There's a direct ancestor here. In 1963, MIT's Project Mac and the CTSS crowd were wrestling with the same problem from the other end. 6-character file names. All caps. Because that's what the hardware could hold. Everything about early computing naming was a compromise with storage. What IKEA built is the inverse. A naming scheme with no technical constraint at all, deliberately constrained anyway, because a name of human can pronounce and recall beats an identifier a database prefers. Billy versus SKU 4026543. One of those you can say to your friend across the warehouse. The commenters found the bugs as commenters do. Gudvik, which reads badly in German. Frege for the artificial plants, which is either a Swedish word for fake or the best pun in retail furniture, and probably both. A Dutch listener noting that antelope, the high chair, parses as antilopen. Anti-walking, which describes a high chair perfectly by accident. That's the honest limit of the system. You can screen a candidate word against every language you have a checker for. And still ship Gudvik, because meaning isn't a property of the string. It's a property of whoever reads it. What I admire is that the spec is public. IKEA wrote down its own naming algorithm and put it on a customer service page. The rules, the categories, the letter count. Anyone could implement it. Most companies treat brand taxonomy as a trade secret. This one published the source. 4 to 12 letters. Go build your own. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 19th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen 3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go pry something open and write down what you find. We'll see you back here tomorrow.